This is Radio EcoShock.
First and foremost, a big thank you to Alex Smith and Radio EcoShock for hosting this content. My name's Eugen Lee, and I hope to spread awareness of the now annual haze blanketing Southeast Asia. I'm joined in this debate by several experts on the issues surrounding the haze. Dr. Helena Vaki, Senior Lecturer at the University of Malaya, Alan Tan, Professor of the National University of Singapore Law School, and Dr. Rachel Carmenta, Postdoctoral Fellow at C4, the Centre for International Forestry Research in Indonesia. Dr. Carmenta, what was the haze like last year?
In 2015, when the fires are extensive and the wind is blowing in the right direction, the haze affects Singapore, it affects Thailand, it affects Malaysia, and locally, obviously, the effects are also significant. There was weeks without sun because the air was sort of a yellow, smoky colour.
How exactly is this haze produced, Dr. Barbie?
There is natural fires, then there's also man-made fires. In the past, before the 1990s, we also had transboundary haze, but not very bad. And this was primarily from either natural fires or slash and burn fires. But in the recent years, with the agribusiness boom, especially in Indonesia and Malaysia, where there's a huge push for oil palm now, this is where we have a more serious haze because the scale is much larger. So nowadays, the source of it, we can say, is largely man-made.
But there are other factors too.
Scarcity of land has pushed the agribusiness sector to target peatland for conversion. Once drained, peat soils become the consummate fuel for haze-producing fires.
So the haze is heavily sort of influenced by wind direction and also the density of the fires burning and what land they're burning, because peatland actually creates more haze than mineral soils.
Peatlands are literally wet and flooded. When plantations come in and they want to develop these peatlands, the first thing they must do is they have to drain the peatland. When these peatlands are usually wet and then they are dried out, they become very fire prone.
Indonesia has been the main source of the haze in recent years,
although there are many laws banning the use of open fires, especially in peatland areas. Dr. Vaki's work on patronage politics describes what she calls instrumental friendships between the patrons and their clients, that is to say, the political elite and agribusinesses, such as oil palm plantations.
We have a lot of clients, which are agribusiness companies, or rather individuals within these companies, which have connections, which have friendships with political elite, either at the local level or at the central level. You know, at local means the Kabupaten level, and central as in the ministry level or even the ministers and all that. So because of these friendships that they have, these plantation companies are able to, number one, get licenses where they're not supposed to get licenses, particularly peatlands. And number two, they are able to, if a fire is found on their property, either they did it purposely or accidentally, they can get away with it. They can either delay the police from coming to investigate, or they can make sure that if a case goes to court, it's usually kicked out before it gets any decision.
There have been numerous attempts to mitigate the haze in terms of national-scale firefighting efforts, as well as the haze agreement of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, back in 2002. One recent development was the introduction of the Singaporean Transboundary Haze Act in 2014, which allows Singapore to prosecute haze-producing companies in Indonesia that are headquartered or closely linked to Singapore. Professor Tan describes how this works in more detail.
The maps that show ownership and control of plantation lands are often inaccurate or contradicting. Contradicting meaning that there could be even more than one map, there could be two or three maps issued by different regional governments or different departments that actually show overlapping concessions on the ground. The first legal presumption is that if there are any maps to show that a particular area belongs to a certain company, it shall be presumed under Singapore law that that company owns that piece of land. The second presumption is that if there is meteorological evidence at the time of a particularly bad haze episode in Singapore to show that the winds are blowing generally from the direction of that piece of land in question in the direction of Singapore, it can be presumed under law that the smoke is coming from that particular piece of land. The third legal presumption that completes the puzzle, if you like, is that it shall then be presumed under Singapore law that that offending company will then be responsible for creating that smoke that has drifted into Singapore.
In correspondence with the first presumption regarding accurate maps, Indonesia launched what it called the One Map Initiative in order to reduce ambiguity of plantation concessions. But there are significant hurdles in the way.
Meteorological evidence, including satellite evidence, will be used, but the reality, of course, is that satellite evidence pinpointing the hotspots or the fires that occurred on certain lands cannot always be 100% accurate. Satellite evidence is almost always compromised if there is bad weather or cloudy, excessive cloud formation.
The relationship of smallholders to plantations is a very complicated thing, actually. A lot of these smallholders and plantations exist in sort of symbiotic relationship with each other. So the plantations sometimes have smallholders on their land as well. And then the smallholders on their land would develop their own trees and sell the plants directly to the plantations. So that is something that it has been going on for many years and it's sort of like a trend. But in terms of this fire, the thing that we often see is that sometimes plantations take advantage of smallholders in the sense that if a fire does occur on plantations, they usually blame the smallholders.
Well, under the Singapore Transboundary Haze Pollution Act, the companies can be fined up to $1 million and be made to pay a certain amount of fines for every day that the fires continue to burn. So there are some hefty penalties that are prescribed under the Singapore Transboundary Haze Pollution Act. But again, the problem is identifying the actual defendants to prosecute and to ensure that the evidence that's presented before the courts is watertight enough to convince the judges that that particular company is to be held liable for a particularly bad haze episode that's afflicting Singapore.
This act allows Singaporean external investors to be made culpable for their role in causing indiscriminate open fires and therefore haze. But there are many other stakeholders involved and affected. Dr. Carmenta has identified these stakeholders in Riau, a province in Indonesia.
They included sort of the sharecroppers and the landless who were working in the plantations and have some, you know, responsibility for those daily actions of maintaining the plantation and keeping the, applying the fertilizer and all these other, clearing the land, operating the machinery. Then there are also the smallholders, and they range massively in terms of how much land do they have and how much capital also. We tend to talk about a smallholder as though it's one sort of unified group, and actually there's a lot of variation there in power and assets and also in land. We identified the local policy communities, which included the NGOs and the different sort of district level government agencies. We also included the Jakarta-based policy community.
C4 has found some agreement between these stakeholders on how to tackle the problem phase, such as incentives to plant land more quickly in order to reduce the susceptibility of fire in idle forest areas. There are other solutions, but under more contention.
And then the ones which were most contested, but at the same time, on average, most regarded as most effective, they included reflooding peatlands, which would prevent the agricultural expansion that we see, because those crops are not water tolerant. That was regarded as effective, but absolutely contested, because, of course, the implication then for some of those stakeholders is severe. Another one which is regarded as most effective but contested is revoking road company licenses if they're found to be burning. And then, interestingly, actually, the third was using canals, expanded use of canals as fire breaks and for firefighting. And that's an action that we saw being pursued, but it's one that also there's a lot of disagreement about.
Within areas of agreement for the stakeholders, incentivizing sustainable development is a hot topic. But how can local incentives be created effectively?
Money can be useful, but it has to be directed and targeted at fundamental sustainable solutions and not just money to be given to smallholders to tell them not to burn.
With this in mind, the private sector in Indonesia has launched a fire-free alliance with a performance reward scheme.
The community will receive a payment of 100 juta, which is 100 million rupiah, at the end of a year if they didn't have any fire in their jurisdiction. And then they receive half of that reward if they only had small fires. And then that reward is not paid in cash but in kind. And so this model is apparently effective. The research hasn't been done yet.
But this initiative is not without its obstacles.
A farmer might want to convert 15 hectares, but actually, if you look at what they have in terms of capital to buy seedlings and to maintain the plot, they couldn't manage, you know, they'd not made that equation in an informed way. And so part of this outreach is helping to make a stronger business plan. And it can only happen, though, if the land tenure is clear. So I know that that's, land tenure has been a problem for the programme because the company can't help a smallholder to clear land unless the smallholder can demonstrate that the land is theirs.
The local economy has also reacted in the way that banks give out loans.
So they don't simply want to give out loans unless you can prove that you have sustainable practice. This is a positive development.
On the international scene, the UN launched its Red Plus, or Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation scheme in Indonesia in recent years. What does this entail exactly?
Well, Red Plus is a payment for performance. It's ultimately a reward, an incentive for good behaviour. And in this case, it would be for avoiding deforestation and degradation, and now has expanded to include restoration also.
The Norwegians already have a Red Plus project in Indonesia that effectively provides money in order to cordon off certain tracts of land for sustainable conservation purposes and do not have those lands be converted for commercial exploitation. But those projects are still very small scale at the moment and appear to be just drops in the ocean.
We have a paper writing about the importance of including fire in Red Plus, because if you can't account for fire and improve fire management, then that's a big risk to the performance of your project, of your Red Plus initiative. And I, so far as I understand, very few projects in Indonesia do account for fire.
Since his inauguration in 2014, Indonesia's President Joko Widodo, or Jokowi, started a seemingly positive shift towards more pro-environmental behaviour, including the launch of the BRG, the Peatland Restoration Task Force Agency, and the merging of the Ministries of the Environment and Forestry. What does the merger spell for the cooperation of the two ministries in the reduction of fires?
There hopefully is going to be a more of a check and balance where the environmental concerns should also play a role in giving out licenses. But there's also a lot of skepticism because previously, before the Ministry of Environment was part of the Forestry Ministry, the Ministry of Environment was viewed as a very weak ministry without much clout. And the Forestry and Agriculture Ministry usually overrode a lot of the Ministry of Environment's concerns.
Much of the aforementioned work by C4 and Dr. Carmenta on evaluating solutions to the haze will be of great value to the BRG, headed by Pak Nasir. The agency clearly shows that peatland restoration is the focus of Indonesia's move towards fire prevention, but it is not without its teething problems.
Well, the way I understand from speaking with Pak Nasir last week is that the Peatland Restoration Agency actually has no legal weight. And so even like a question that would come before that one would be, how can the Peatland Restoration Agency get these large companies to even rewet any of their land whatsoever? Because they're going to lose, they're going to have to flood their own crops.
Dr. Vahi, is there a best solution?
think the policies are all there, the laws are all there, but it's just the implementation. And as I said, what makes implementation very difficult is patronage. So it requires a really dismantling of this patronage system, and hopefully the change that is bringing about by Jokowi would be able to bring that, because Jokowi does not come from any traditional long-serving political family. So he's a bit outside from the network.
Professor Tan.
Well, I don't think that this act can prescribe a long-term solution. They really require deep-seated reform of land use policies, of forest and land use management within Indonesia itself. But the reality is that the oil palm and paper plantations continue to generate a lot of revenue for the Indonesian economy. And so that essentially comes in the way of the Indonesian authorities clamping down hard on these actors for their offending activities.
Dr. Kamenta?
I think it's clear that there will have to be a mix of improved sanctioning, better designed incentive structures, stronger governance and enforcement. That would be facilitated by some clarity on land tenure. And then, of course, it will be no one-size-fits-all, because the landscapes vary in terms of what stakeholders are present. And one incentive structure for one stakeholder is not necessarily going to be appropriate for another.
And finally, as palm oil is so pervasive in everyday products, can we as consumers have a direct effect on its sustainable production?
Realistically, or if you look at the numbers, most of the palm oil exported from Malaysia and Indonesia, it goes to other parts of the region as well, especially China and India and Middle East. So these consumers, they are not so concerned about where it comes from, whether it's sustainable or not.
That's all we have time for. Thank you so much once again to Dr. Helena Varkey, Professor Alan Tan, and Dr. Rachel Carmenta.